Welcome to Kinfolk Lore. Today we're here to discuss the fifth episode of one of our favorite costume dramas, The Gilded Age. We're excited to track all the drama between Team New Money and Team Old Money as they fight for power in New York's high society at the end of the 19th century. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul, and for those of you joining us for the first time, we're cousins who love to explore fantasy and sci-fi stories, and last year we expanded our coverage to discuss our favorite period pieces. We kicked off that coverage discussing the Gilded Age, and so we're back to discuss Julian Fellowes's newest project with more in-depth analysis. You can find our episodes on Downton Abbey, Bridgerton, Outlander, and The Crown in your podcast feeds.
We're very excited to spend this week catching up with the Russells, the Van Ryan clan, and all of the many rich characters in this costume drama. This week, Peggy and Mr. Fortune run into serious trouble in Alabama. Agnes has a complete and utter meltdown because of Ida's impending wedding. And Watson, aka Mr. Collier, saves the Russells' dinner for the Duke by thwarting Turner's plan to ruin it.
And the real question is, how long will we continue to have adult content? Well, in the words of my guy Larry Russell, I suppose until it stops being fun. If you're here for discussions of after-dinner party makeup sex or risque kisses in a barn, you have come to the right place to enjoy it all. And I guarantee you will have more fun than Turner, who prefers torture, literal torture, over a Russell dinner party. Wild stuff from our girl Turner. Oh, man. So where do we begin? I guess we'll begin with Team New Money, where Larry begins this episode day drinking with his friend. Oh, my gosh.
Pathetic. I was just like, Larry.
Listen,
what are we doing here, bro?
The best take of the whole thing is when his mom's like, is this what they taught you at Harvard? And he goes, basically. Oh, man. His mother prepares for the dinner with the Duke of Buckingham in Newport, and she's like, you know what? You got to get out of here, man. You need to clear your head. This will be good. You need to not think about the breakup. And so she sends him back to NYC, where his father's going to have something for him to do, and he's going to go and meet with the chief engineer for the Brooklyn Bridge, who has become increasingly elusive lately. So his father wants him to check it out. While Bertha works with Church and Mrs. Bruce to prepare for the Duke, Turner invites Peter Burns, one of the footmen working in the Russells' household, and she tells him about her plan to sabotage the entire dinner, Turner doing Turner things.
This is basement bargain basement Barrow, okay? This is not Thomas, all right? This guy sucks.
He's terrible.
Thomas would have never messed up this plan. If Thomas was behind this plan, the Duke would have definitely had soup in his lap.
Yeah.
Right? This guy stinks. That's why he didn't get a name until like this episode. Okay?
I'm just mad that that was even the plan. Was like, let's just dump soup in the Duke's lap. It's crazy. That's nuts. But you're right. 100%. Thomas was so good that it created a problem for the household, for sure.
Yeah, this is like the most ridiculous, childish prank. Thomas would have had the Duke out here declaring war on America. Like that's how he rolled, right?
Oh my gosh. So back in the city, Larry discovers that it's actually Mrs. Roebling, the chief engineer's wife, who is overseeing the building of the Brooklyn Bridge. More on that later. Mr. Roebling, he took ill, and his wife has continued the project without him. Pretty cool. And Turner's plan ends up being thwarted, as we've gone over, because of Watson's careful eye. Watson peeped out the whole plan. He saw the cook putting stuff inside the food for the first course. He thought through who's going to be serving the Duke, and he's like, yeah, everything's done. So, of course, Church goes in, stops the plan, and, you know, Turner to, you know, some of the party guests, observation, looks a little perturbed. She's upset. Oh, man. So, and that is what's happening with Team New Money.
Team Old Money had a rough episode. All right, let's just call it what it is. Had a rough episode. Agnes had a complete meltdown. Not quite as bad as Turner's meltdown at the end of last episode, but not far off.
Pretty close.
pretty close. Full on tantrum when she learns about her sister's engagement to Mr. Forte.
To she quote Oscar, this is harsh even for you, mother. This is harsh.
It just also, this whole thing just showed too how much Oscar's under his mother's spell.
Yeah.
He's like, I forbid you from attending.
Oh my
gosh.
And
she forbids him and he basically agrees. Like, shocking stuff.
Yeah.
She also causes a real crisis of confidence for Ada, who doesn't want to fight with her sister. These two have been together for a long time, and she doesn't really want something that she's done to create a break between her and her sister. Oscar also has, if not love, at least matrimony on the mind.
Mm-hmm.
He accompanies Maud Beaton to meet with her business manager, Mr. Chowder, and learns about a potential secret investment scheme to take over the Chicago Atlantic Railroad.
Hmm.
In Alabama, at the opening of the Tuskegee dorm, Mr. Fortune and Peggy are encouraged to visit the restaurant of one of the students' mothers. After their meal, two belligerent white men come into the restaurant to start trouble with the owner. Mr. Fortune intervenes, and he and Peggy have to flee the restaurant. Booker T. Washington hides them in an abandoned barn where they wait all night as an angry crowd of white men search for them. In their fear, the two share a kiss. I have a lot to say about this.
A whole lot to say.
I have a lot to say. We will come back. In the final scene, Ada and the Reverend Forte get married, and Oscar has defied his mother to show up for his aunt and walk her down the aisle. It was so sweet. And also, it was just really nice that she had two people willing to walk her down the aisle. Both Dashiell and Oscar were there to do it. Marion is her maid of honor, and the entire Van Ryan household, including Bannister, shows up.
Well, Bannister gets props on this episode because he actually pushed Agnes over the edge a little bit. Like, everybody else staying the course, and he was like, yo, I'm going, and you should go too, because you're going to regret this. I was pretty proud of Bannister. Like,
yeah,
in that moment.
It was just great, though, that her entire household was like, yeah, whatever, we're going. So good. Just as the ceremony began, Agnes did show up, making a wild dramatic entrance.
Oh, so much to say about this. This is ridiculous. At her sister's wedding. Like, what are you doing? Like, oh, goodness. Go ahead.
She was acting like she was going to a funeral.
Yeah, it was crazy.
She came into that wedding with, like, the energy of a mistress who's been forbidden from coming to the funeral. That's what she was doing.
Like, that scene normally, like, is if anyone has any reason why these two should not be wed, for speak now, forever hold your peace. That's normally the walk-in moment that you hear that shit. And, like, thank goodness that she didn't come in at that moment and she came in a little bit earlier. But that's the energy that it felt like. She was like, it was weird. It was so weird. But luckily she got in line and just came, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that it was both the smart thing to do, but also Shudder just demonstrates that, like, even though she's stubborn and stuck in her ways, like, she does recognize how important it is to show up for family.
Yeah.
I think that's one thing we can say about Agnes. Even though she's ridiculous, for the most part, she's doing what she believes her family, like, is best for her family.
And it's consistent. She believes she is not what you would call, an early adopter. She's like she's gonna hold on to the old ways or whatever she's familiar with as long as she possibly can. So it seems like that's where this was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And she genuinely didn't want to, like, lose the everyday banter and sitting with her sister that she was feeling like she was gonna lose, you know?
Yeah.
So
totally.
Man. So we're already talking about the wedding. Let's talk about the wedding. I think like, you know, she's We kind of talked about it a little bit, but, you know, it's kind of like you see Agnes really strong, but it's kind of wild to actually dig in a little bit deeper and realize that she's really afraid of, like, being alone. She's really, truly, like, in this moment, like, that's what's driving a lot of this, is fear.
Yeah, I like that he explored. We should say that, because Julian Fellowes is not the only writer.
Yeah.
But I like that they're exploring this, because again, like, a thing that we've noted about this show is that it doesn't just focus on the lives of the young people. This show is not just about Gladys and Larry and Peggy and Marion. It's also about the lives of the older and middle-aged folks. And Agnes is in a situation that is not uncommon, even now, for widows, which is that she's has to adapt to the potential of having an empty nest entirely. And I think she had in her mind that Ada was going to be with her forever, that they, the two were going to grow very old together. And now that's being taken away from her. And she knows that Oscar and Marion both are going to marry in the next few years. So I think that this is, you know, this is clearly a plot point that I think resonates with a lot of people. Like, you can feel sympathy for Agnes when she's sitting there at the dinner table by herself. You're like, oh, this is like what her life will be like, you know?
I mean, I feel sympathy for her, but also she said some wild shit. Like, you're a spinster. You've always been a spinster.
Oh, yeah.
Yo, she's wild. And she made Bannister, like, take back his congratulations. It would that these are two of the funniest and saddest moments in this episode. It's kind of wild. The spinster moment.
Yeah, no, she, listen. Agnes's tongue is something, is formidable. And one day she's going to say something that someone is not going to forgive her for.
Yeah.
They give her a lot of grace. Like, a lot of grace. She was straight up cruel here.
Yeah.
But that was coming from a place of real fear about living her days alone. But then the flip side of that was she should have treats Ada like a paid companion. Just hire a companion.
Yeah, agreed.
As Mr. Winterton reminded us, that's like fairly common. Yeah. Like, just hire a companion. Like, if you really need someone to sit at the dinner table with you, just hire a companion. Like, she has enough money to do it. I understand that she's mourning the loss of her sister, but to stand in the way of her sister's happiness just because Agnes's marriage was unhappy and she feels that she deserves to have everyone treat her with a certain kind of regard because she lived through an unhappy marriage. That's no reason to have Ada out here giving up a potential for happiness.
100%. I mean, there's one unexplored fact that we don't really think about, though. I mean, at least I hadn't thought about till earlier today. And I was like, you know, one thing that justifies Agnes being this way is that once everybody leaves the house, her one source for human companionship, if she doesn't hire a companion, would be Armstrong. Yeah, I'd be fucking rough. Mad. I'd be rough.
It's rough. It's rough. We can't ignore it. That's really rough.
Yeah, exactly. Armstrong would be it. That's fucking wild. And you know, I also think it was an interesting conversation. I liked the conversation with Aunt Ada and with Mr. Forte, where Mr. Forte encourages her to like not make any decision about whether they should get married or not until she speaks to Marion. And it really shows that Marion's really starting to emerge as like a leader in the family. Like, and she's really starting to take like that central role in like managing these things behind the scenes. Like, she even, you know, pushed Agnes to kind of like, she even pushed Aunt Ada to tell Aunt Agnes the way that she did. You know what I mean? So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I like this new role for Marion because everyone seems to see her as the voice of reason. And I also think that the fact that she hasn't completely changed the way that she moves in the world just because of what happened with Mr. Rakes is a great character. It shows how strong-willed she is. You know, a lot of young women, I think, would have, you know, gone into basically like hiding, right? There's a little bit of scandal attached to it. Aunt Agnes was right about Mr. Rakes. But Marion is kind of just doing her own thing. She hasn't given up teaching, even though her aunt really hates it. And she's financially dependent on them. And I think
next
that's
be asking
what...
you to next they'll be asking you to beat out the Mets. Oh God, yeah. Agnes, goodness. Oh,
she has so many good. She really hates this school. Like, she has so many good one-liners about the school. And what is really funny to me is that. And this is not like, I don't think Agnes would have this self-awareness or any character in her situation. Mm-hmm. I know she's not aware of Peggy's situation, but I would say that if not for race, Peggy and Marion are on the same, like, social, in the same social standing.
Yeah.
Right? 100%. Like, Peggy's parents are pretty well off. They're not, I would say they're, at the very least, upper middle class, if not wealthy. Mm-hmm. Okay, but, like, Peggy eats with the servants and has a job and doesn't bother Agnes at all because, like, obviously she feels that that's the role of a Black woman in this household. But Marion can't even, like, help move classroom furniture.
Oh, my God. It's so crazy. She doesn't hold back on any of these things. Yeah, all her bias. And then she acts like, you know, I love that Marion calls her out, too, about acting, like, kind of, like, unaware. In one of, to me, one of the funniest scenes with her and Bannister in a while is when they're sitting there to eat and she's all like, well, why isn't Ada coming down? And Marion's like, come on, like, we can accuse you of a lot, but we're not going to act like she's basically like, you're not dumb. Like, you understand that you were super rude to Aunt Ada and that's why she's not coming down. And then Marion bounces too.
Yeah. Everyone, like, honestly, the whole Van Ryn household was great in this episode. Like, they really rallied behind Ada. They defied their mistress. I still am, like, a little bit stunned by the fact that she made Bannister take back his congratulations.
Yeah, he's stunned about a lot of stuff. That's why I was so shocked when he gave her that little word of advice, because when he's coming out, she's like, et tu, Bannister.
I was dying when she was like, you must take back your congratulations. He was like, Miss Ada, I must cancel my congratulations. It was so good.
Goodness gracious, man. And speaking of Bannister, let's talk about how this marriage, like, the conversation that happens about the servants downstairs, they're talking about this and what this might impact for them. And when people leave the household, get married, I guess we really get a good sense of, like, the way the upstairs movement can affect the livelihoods and the outcome for a lot of the downstairs staff.
Yeah, I love these conversations. These were, for me, this was what was missing last season, was I just didn't feel like the downstairs staff got much of a life, aside from, like, Armstrong being a racist in the failed romance between Jack and Bridget. I love the acknowledgement that this upstairs downstairs dynamic, which is, you know, been a dynamic in these types of shows since the show Upstairs Downstairs, are important because these people live extremely close together, right? Their living is close as families live today. And so what happens upstairs does have a big impact on downstairs. But also what I loved about this conversation is it revealed something that we didn't know, you know, had she seen, which is that Bridget saw what happened between John Adams and Oscar when Oscar was in bed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we're pretty sure she saw it based on what she says in this conversation, because there's that, you know, what happens? I think it's the cook who asks, well, you know, what will happen when maybe Mr. Oscar will get married and him and his bride will come and live here. I hope if he does get married, that's the case, because he cannot take his future wife to his apartment. Like, yeah, dude, yeah, it's a bachelor pad. And Bridget responds that she's doubtful that he will marry.
Yeah.
So I think that I just want to note it, because I think that plot line could be coming back at some point.
Yeah, I agree. I think we talked about this offline a little bit, and I thought that you had some really good points about it, and I think we should keep an eye on that. Like, that her, they, you know, one thing, I mean, sometimes he does, but very rarely does Julian Fellowes or and his writing staff, like, plant something and not come back to it.
Yep.
Like, it doesn't happen that often, you know?
It really doesn't. I mean, there are things that were in Belgravia in, like, episode one that came back to be really important in the finale. And then the same thing with Downton Abbey. I actually haven't watched Dr. Thorne, which was Julian Fellowes' other series. I just, like, could not get into it. I might try it again. But I can say for Gosford Park, which is the show, that the movie that kind of put him on the map, every single line is important, no matter how minor it is. And so Bridget noting that she is aware that there might be a barrier of Mr. Oscar getting married. Yeah, we're supposed to note that. That's going to come back for sure.
100%. And there is a lot happening downstairs also this episode over with the Russell clan, both mainly in Newport, right? Like, it's mainly in Newport, but, you know, Adelheid is not happy about the possibility of being replaced. But
I can't with this girl. I'm sorry. I just, like, cannot feel sorry for her.
Why are you mad at Jack's boo-boo? Jack is like, Adelheid, oh. I love Jack. Why are you mad at her? Tell me, what is the main thing that irritates you about Adelheid?
She's, like, not good at her job. Yeah. And she's upset because Mrs. Russell wants to find someone more experienced. Dude, you're not trained. You're not good at your job. Be happy for the place that you have as Gladys's lady's maid. Because in the end, it's very likely that if Gladys does marry, she'll keep her. That's a big deal.
110%.
So, like, I don't understand. Like, she's not good. She literally left the woman's dress at home.
It's the classic, like, you're doing too much. Like, you already are Gladys's lady's maid, and now you want to pull double duty when you're barely doing the first job well. You're like, no, I just don't want anybody. Like, what are you so threatened by? Like, this is a good thing. Like, you'll get to get back to what you do best, get even better at it. And, like, you know, like she was told, you'd stand to learn something. You know what I mean? Just by watching.
100%. And I just feel like she doesn't even have to pick Gladys's clothes. Like,
yeah,
her mom does that. So it's like, why? Like, I don't know. Just learn, Bridget. Bridget's very young. How old could this girl be? Like 16, 17?
She's young. Super young.
Yeah, just learn. Like, I don't understand why you're trying to go too far in life too quickly.
And so, boy, anyway, does Mrs. Russell pick Gladys's clothes. She's like, but your choices would be wrong.
That was rough. But listen, Gladys looked great.
Yeah,
she wasn't wrong.
She's like, you got named the best dressed debutante of the season. You think that happens by accident? Trust me on this. I'm the shit. All right. Let me. And, you know, to be honest, Mrs. Russell, her wardrobe is crazy dope.
Yeah.
You know
she's what I mean? The best dressed woman on this show.
Yeah.
Gladys, again, you could learn something.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oh, man. And all right, let's talk about something that happened just for a second, and then we'll talk about Tuskegee. But it's important because we get a Marion and Larry moment just for a hot second. But for us on this pod, we are hyped about it. Like, he comes home, he's got some heartbreak, she runs across the street. I mean, she's like, oh my God, this is such a surprise. She's so happy. And he is very happy to be like, yo, I can accompany you on this walk and I can tell you everything, crying on the shoulder. I love it for them. I love it. Nothing happens, but I love it.
I'm all in my handwritten notes. It's in all caps. Marion and Larry go for a walk. Like, legit. I need these two to stop messing around with these people who are not right for them and just come home, man. Just let's make this happen. Why are we resisting it?
Yeah. And she picked up on all the cues. He was like, unfortunately, I had to come back. And she's like, why unfortunately? she was right there for it. I was like, Marion.
Well, she knew what was going down with Mrs. Blaine.
Oh, yeah. Mrs. Blaine. Yeah, Mrs. Blaine knew what was going down. She's picking up the vibe. Mrs. Blaine was like, oh, you again. And from one romance that we completely co-sign to a budding one that I am completely out on happening in Tuskegee. First, let's start with the overall stuff that happened in Tuskegee, and then we'll deal into what the fuck is happening here. So the dormitory gets opened. It's really cool. Like, it was cool to see. I thought it was a really cool, well-shot scene. The dormitory looks amazing.
It looks great. Yeah. It looks really, really, really cool. I think they note that this is, you know, one of the largest buildings in the state. Like, what an accomplishment, right? Yeah. Especially within the context that we have in this episode, which is that even though there's some progress being made for Black people in the South, there's still a lot of danger. Dormitory scene was cool.
Yeah, I liked it. I loved the interview. Thought it was interesting. Peggy is always on the job. She's like, oh, let me talk to you. Like, tell me what you think. How does it feel? Like, you know, oh yeah, I met your girlfriend. That sounds, you know, like she's like right away, like getting the story, which I always love about Peggy. She is like very focused on, I'm going to do this job really well. And you know, he drops something about, you know, I want to go and become a farmer so I can help supply my mom's restaurant.
He's got that farm to table thing going already.
Already. Early farm to table. And they go to the restaurant. They get invited. They go to the restaurant. And that's where shit goes left. The one-on-one dinner date in the Deep South was probably like, we're like, okay, something's going to happen here. I thought it was going to go, I mean, I knew there was going to be some danger, but I didn't think it was going to go this far. And man, like, it goes left. So, you know, two white men walk in, confront the owner, the young man's mom. He starts to get physical with her. He's obviously seems intoxicated and starts to get physical, to which Mr. Fortune is like, nah. And, you know, tries to defend the lady. And I have so many thoughts about this because, like, modern day, obviously, yes, this is the move. Go for it. In that situation, it's still the move, but, man, it has consequences. You know what I mean? And he should have known the consequences and maybe tried to de-escalate a little bit, but this leads to them directly having to get out of the restaurant to, you know, after pushing down one of the men.
Yeah, I thought this scene was going to go down differently. I really thought what was going to happen was that in the moment he would realize how dangerous it was and not do anything. Yeah. And then there would be like almost like a reconciliation between him and Mr. Booker of basically, you know, acknowledging that the struggle is not as simple as he had earlier stated that he believed it was. But instead what happens is he comes from a trauma response. And like, I know that that's like an overused TikTok terminology these days, but I think that's what's really happening here. Mm-hmm. He's watching a Black woman be threatened with violence from a belligerent white man who's literally just there to fuck with her. Like, he's not there for any reason. If anyone believes that this man couldn't have gone to any restaurant in town or just gone home and gotten a meal without causing this drama, like, that's not the case. Like, he's literally there just to menace.
And not only just to menace, to remind them of what he perceives as their place in society. You know? Yep.
And like, that's what racial violence is like. It doesn't have purpose other than to intimidate and to strike terror into the hearts of the people who are just living their lives. This woman's not trying to register people to vote. She's serving food in a restaurant that she made with her own hands. And so I thought Mr. Fortune, when the scene started, I was like, what's going to happen here? Is it's going to get aggressive? He's going to consider, you know, doing something, and then he's going to come to his senses and not, because Peggy is there and he doesn't want to get Peggy in danger. The exact opposite happens. As soon as he stood up, I was like, no. Like, yeah. You are responsible for this, what, 21-year-old young woman who is sitting at the same table with you. Like, you are putting everyone in more danger here. And I think by the end of the episode, he realizes the foolishness of what he's done. And then he does something else foolish, which is he kisses Peggy, which I'm just like, yeah. Dude, you're married.
Yeah. We want so much better for Peggy in this situation.
This is absurd. I'm like deeply angry about this. Listen, Mr. Fortune is fine. I get it. He's a good looking man. He's educated.
Brave.
I understand why Peggy is tempted, but he's also married and he's a high profile figure in the Black community. This is a type of thing that if she makes one misstep, it could ruin her. Like, the scandal would ruin her. Like, Marianne tried to warn her about traveling with him. Like, if there anyone gets a whiff of romance between them, like, she's ruined and she won't have her rich auntie or anyone else to cover it up.
Both like warnings are coming to fruition in this episode. Warning from Peggy's mom and about how Black people are treated in the South, and the warning that Marianne gave about traveling alone. And I like your version of what I wish the writers would have done in this scene more. I really wish they would have let it escalate to the point of almost tragedy, de-escalate, and then they could have still gotten to the kiss scene and maybe a way of them being alone and him being like, I just thought so much about like what might have happened to you. And I didn't want anything to happen. And then, like, he goes in for the kiss and they could still make it as risky versus this. Because what I don't love about it going as far as it did is that there is no way, from everything that I know from family stories to everything that I know from reading, that push incident happens, those guys walk by with the torches, and then nothing else happens.
Yep, like, there's no way. They would have burned Booker T. Washington's house to the ground.
Burned his house to the ground. There's a possibility of a lynching. There's a possibility that restaurant gets burned down, that lady and her son pay for it. There is no way that just goes on. And that's why I thought this was very sanitized, and it was my least favorite part of them letting it escalate that far. I like that they didn't want to show most likely the choice, because he does have a lot of Black people in the writer room, was like, we don't want to show more violence against Black people. So then win the battle then in the writing room about it not getting to the point where violence was necessary, and it just getting to the point where where you feel the tension and the danger and then de-escalate it and then still get to your kiss scene. Because I don't believe this plays out this way at all as a viewer. At all. So
yeah, I totally agree. I was left wondering, would we see next episode, would he get a letter from Booker T. Washington saying the restaurant had been burnt down? Because when they can't find him and Peggy, they're going to find somebody.
Exactly.
Exactly. So, you know, we'll see. Maybe this plot line will come back at some point. But I had the same feeling. It just didn't feel true to what would have likely happened. But the flip side is, I think there's been a lot of discourse about like white written shows that depict racism and having Black people be docile and not fight back. And so I wonder if that was driving part of this conversation. I just think that if we're going to go there, the consequences should be more than you get stuck in a barn overnight. Like, how did these people even get out?
Because he says, you guys hide under the barn and we'll get you on a train in the morning. There's no way they're not camping out at the train in the morning. Like, people got hung in broad daylight back then. Like, that's not like it only had to happen at night with, like, some tiki torches. You know what I mean? Like, that's not...
That's not the tiki torches!
Yeah, I had to get it in. I couldn't help it. That's the first thing I thought about, was like, oh, wait, is this like Virginia with tiki torches?
Oh, man.
But yeah, you know, like this is not that time, like in history, you know? So anyway, I just think I think they had to write themselves out of a corner, because I don't really truly think they needed to go down south, in my opinion. It was nice that they got in this part of a storyline, but the real storyline, you know, there's a lot to explore around provincialism and segregation and the rights of black people in the Northeast, and not need to even go down south. You know what I mean? So let's see where this goes.
So I actually think this is in response to something that there was a lot of criticism about on Downton Abbey. Mm-hmm. And I know that we keep comparing the show to Downton Abbey, but part of it is that Fellows originally conceived this show as a prequel to Downton Abbey. He went in a different direction, but
has acknowledged that it's still in the Downton Abbey universe. Like, this is still, that's what I've read, that he said that this is still happening inside that world.
You right. Know what I mean? So the shows are somewhat loosely connected.
Yeah.
But we had 7 seasons of Tom Branson mm-hmm. ranting about the injustices in Ireland, and we never got there.
Yeah.
We never actually got to see the injustices, which made him seem, in the setting of Downton Abbey, like he was this lunatic who was just obsessed with the Irish struggle, when things were actually quite bad for the Irish at the time of Downton Abbey, mm-hmm. Which is the 1920s, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we know from history that things were really bad in Ireland, and that the British were brutally oppressing Irish people. And like, so I think part of it is that there was a lot of criticism when Downton was airing that, like, Tom is a stand-in for the working class Irishman, but we never actually get to see what he's complaining about. Everything that happens in Ireland happens off screen.
Yeah.
I think that this was an attempt to show, like, we're really looking at the Gilded Age. And the Gilded Age means a lot of things. New York City is the main setting, but this was also a time in the country that was where things, the whole phrase, the Gilded Age, comes from the notion that they were covering up with money and extravagance the real pain and suffering of the majority of people. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why they wanted to go to Tuskegee, because this is a major thing that's happening this year. And they wanted to take us out of our opera fight. Like, think about the other plot this episode, which is a ruined dinner. I think in that way, I have to acknowledge this is dope. I like that they took the story down south. I wish a couple of things. I wish we would have gotten this storyline not juxtaposed with the dinner or the meltdown over a proposal, and gotten it, given it a little bit more time to breathe. Like, maybe Peggy and Mr. Fortune spend like another week in Alabama.
Yeah.
Or that if they were going to go this route, like, there need to be some additional repercussions. I don't feel like they're still safe, you know, just because they got out. Like, I feel like their actions would have reverberated throughout the entire black community, even though they're outsiders.
This would have been a good time. I know this is crazy, because, like, who would think this pairing? This would have been a good time for almost like a buddy travel home. Like, almost like the Hound and Arya Stark style. Like, they need to get out of the South, and they need to, like, go through back channels to do it because of what they did. And to spend more time, maybe another week, getting back to New York, where the two of them are just alone, getting helped by multiple people to get them back to New York, not traveling on the train until they get to the Mason-Dixon line, would have actually allowed us to unpack their relationship and everything a little bit more. I hope that that's where they go, right? You know, this could be a good time for that. You know what I mean?
I totally agree. And I'd also just love to see, I'd love to hear more about Mr. Fortune's experience.
Yeah.
Like, where did this trauma response come from? Like, there's a story there, and I'd love to hear it. Like, he's one of our main characters at this point. Like, I'd love to know more about him. The same way we learned more about Watson. Let's hear about this guy.
Yeah. I just hope that that's where they go, because I don't believe that they're going to get out of the South, like, on the train in the morning. Like, that, I just don't believe that. Right. So it has to go somewhere. Like, it has to. So let's see. Like,
I would be very disappointed if this is the end of that storyline. You know, like, there just needs to be something. They get back to New York, they hear from Mr. Washington, or like they write an article about their experience and it becomes like a thing. I don't know. I don't feel like they would have walked away from this after a sweet kiss in the barn and it's just a story to tell.
So we've talked a lot about the socio kind of like political portion of this. Where does this go with this kiss? Like, what the hell are they going to do? Because now they have to work together under these conditions with this awkwardness, and there's no like dialing that back.
Let me just tell you, if Peggy has to leave her job over this kiss, I'm going to be really pissed. Ugh. Like, that storyline might be realistic, because I think that's probably what should happen, but I'm gonna be really upset if Peggy's like no longer a journalist because he kissed her. That's not a plot line I want to see. I don't know what she knows. He's married. Like, I don't understand this at all. I also just don't need Peggy to suffer another heartbreak this season.
This is what I'm saying. You're fresh. She's fresh off, and he knows that she's fresh off of losing a child. Like, this is a lot. Like, to, like, now throw this into the mix. Like, you know, it's very selfish of him. Like, adding in everything with his wife and his family is one piece, but it's also selfish to, in how he's, like, even thinking about someone who he apparently has wanted to, cares about and wants to give opportunities to. It's just selfish all the way around. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and it's, yeah. So I don't know, man. I don't know where this goes. I think it's like, you know, again, like you said, these young people are just out here, man. They just out here. Like, Larry's out here having his flings. Peggy's out here kissing married guys. Marion is dialing it back this season.
She had her scandal.
She's like, okay, I learned my lesson. Now I'm trying to just dodge Dashiell. You know what? I just realized I forgot to mention when Dashiell's like, I'm surprised that Aunt Agnes has such a strong stance against marriage. She says, no, only for Aunt Ada. And he goes, thank heavens. And Marion's
expression is priceless. She's like, whoa, okay, dude.
Oh, my God. Super heavy-handed. So, I mean.
I don't want to talk about Dashiell this.
I don't really either. I'm with you. I don't either.
I don't have any problem with Dashiell. I think Dashiell is, to this point, he's pretty sweet. He seems like a smart guy. He seems to genuinely like Marion. And it's not him. It's just, I'm over this, okay? She belongs with Larry. I will die on that. Like, this is just wasting time until we get the inevitable matching of Marion and Larry Russell.
Yeah, and they walked hand in hand. Like, they wasn't just like, let's go on a walk, and there was no physical contact. They were like arms linked and walk. I was like, look at them. Okay. You know,
I feel about Dashiell the same way I felt about Mrs. Blaine. Nothing against you personally, but come on, man. Let's wrap this up. We need Marion and Larry just to get together.
Well, love is in the air. People are getting married and everything. And under the backdrop of one of the most iconic, like landmark items in New York, the Brooklyn Bridge. The Brooklyn freaking bridge is being built. I was blown away by this whole storyline.
This whole storyline was really cool. Because it was, for me, this was one of the, this is like one of the biggest things I've learned from watching this show.
Yeah, me too.
This is why I love these shows, right? Because we do the Google. Like, is this true?
Yeah.
This was really, really cool. Mrs. Roebling leading the end of the building of the Brooklyn Bridge is just like one of the coolest things they've done this season, because it was something that is true but unknown. I have walked across the Brooklyn Bridge hundreds of times. And I just assumed, and it also made me check myself, because I was like, I never looked into the history, because I just assume a man designed it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just assumed, and a man did design it, but she oversaw the final stages of construction, which was huge, and also would not have continued without her. This is just so, so, so cool. I loved it. The casting for Mrs. Roblin was great. Like, totally believable. Great acting in this scene. And Larry's response is also really cool. This was another reason I'm like, I'm going to need Larry and Marion to get together.
Mm-hmm.
Because Larry's like, wow, this is incredible, but also sad because you can't let anyone know what you've done. And this is like a great feat. Like, people are going to be talking about this bridge for the ages.
Yeah. And like connecting, like he could be an engineer, a trained engineer himself. He walks in, he sees what she's doing. He connects to, okay, I got to come back and have a one-on-one conversation with her. I'm not going to like out her in this moment, and which was stand up too. And then when they have that one-on-one conversation, it's like they start talking about the like actual like, you know, disciplines in engineering. And I thought it was really cool to see like that exchange. It was really, really cool. And like what her history was and how she learned. So it was really cool.
I would have liked for him to unpack it with his father this episode. I mean, I guess he didn't have time because George Russell went up to Newport.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, they haven't had that conversation, but I will be interested to see how his father responds to this news. I don't know. Listen, you know, I have a mixed bag relationship with the Russells, the father and mother. I don't know if George is going to be nearly as progressive as his children, because I think Gladys would also find this to be incredibly cool.
Yeah, I agree. I think that probably not. I don't know. I'm kind of torn about that too. I guess we'll see. We'll find out. But what I do think it draws a very clear comparison on in our little like mission of like, we really want these two to get together is the traditionalism of like, say, a Dashiell and like the new way, like progressive thinking of a Larry, who I think we're going to see. Like there's a little bit of a contrast generationally and otherwise there. You know what I mean? Like, and I think like Larry is, you know, Larry could get, unlike Agnes, Larry could get behind Marion working at the school and be like, okay, cool, that's awesome. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and I think like this new money and new world and new people in society, it meshes more. I think that's why Marion's always been able to find a good place with Bertha and with George, because it just meshes more with her worldview as well. You know what I mean? So
yeah, definitely. She's definitely more modern. I mean, her best friend is a black woman, right? Mm-hmm. Like, she's definitely more modern and progressive in her sensibilities than I think any member of the Van Ryn clan, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. I think they're all pretty traditional. I think Ada is a little bit more progressive because she has made some mistakes in her past and lived long enough to see that happiness is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. That all of this like tradition and pomp and circumstances is not as important as finding happiness, which is something that she has failed to find, even though she's always done the proper thing for the most part. So I'm interested to see when inevitably, because I believe it will happen, Larry and Marion link up. There's going to be some friction there, I think, on both sides.
I mean, yeah, they're planting the seed. We're not getting this at the end of last season, walk across the street and the freaking like walk to the park after the heartbreak this season. And then the whole exchange of her saying like, well, now we're even, you know, and blah, blah, blah. It's like the seeds are being planted. We just hope it happens. You know what I mean? Like, that's what it comes down to. I don't know. They've gone left before, you know? Like, so that's my Downton angst. There's been times where it's gone left before. So we'll see. But let's talk about our boy Watson / Collier. What
a great episode for our guy.
He was the man in this episode. I mean, so many wins. Undoes Turner's attempt. Tells Mr. Russell about having to deal with the McNeils and wanting to speak to his daughter before he makes a final decision, to which Mr. Russell is like, yeah, I co-sign that. Make sure your daughter's... It's like super duper dope. And the fact that George is like not even tripping about like what happened, like what was his life was before.
Yeah, he couldn't care less. Like, no. He's just... again, the Russells, while I don't think they're always kind, and they do think themselves the best people in any room.
Oh yeah.
I do think that they show a type of respect and deference to people who are not of the same circumstances that I just don't think that the Van Ryns would ever do.
Yep,
right. Or the Astors, right? I really appreciated that George was basically like, I hear that. Like, you got to do what you got to do. You should hear it from your kid.
Yep, agreed. No, it was good. And then saving the night. I mean, let's be honest. Like, Turner was out here trying to spoil everything, mess up the whole evening. And I just love that he caught Peter and the chef and figured out the soup plot and the first course plot. He was like, I think something else is happening. Like, he just kept watching people. Like, his eye, I guess, sharp eye. Sharp eye.
I do want to talk at some point, maybe at the end of the season. I mean, we'll see what happens. But, like, I do want to talk about, are things going too well for Bertha Russell?
You know,
she's, like, legit winning every fight with Turner.
I mean, listen, there's gonna come a point. I think there's gonna come a point, maybe this season, maybe next season, where her luck runs out. I mean, that's everybody. There's gotta come a point. Like, she just keeps, because the problem isn't that it would just automatically run out. The problem is something that I think there is some wisdom in what Agnes says sometimes, is that she's not, it's the problem of enough. It's like she wants more and more and climbing and more. And I think, like, she doesn't have that concept. She's just like, it's always something new. Although I think there is something being presented here in this dinner that we can talk about in a second that shows that she's not out for the Duke just for Duke's sake. Just for the Duke.
Yeah, for sure. But, like, I don't know. I wish it was more of a friction between her and Mrs. Astor this season, because it just feels like ever since getting Mrs. Astor to come to the ball last season to Gladys's coming out, it's just been on the up and up for her. And this is a woman who, like, crawled out of Mrs. Astor's Newport home last season.
Oh, yeah. I know.
That scrappy Bertha that we're so used to seeing is not present right now. And so I'm glad that this dinner did not end with soup on the Duke's lap or head or whatever the plan was. But I don't know. This seemed too easy, right? Like, it just felt like, I was like, oh, Turner's got a whole plot. And then the plot was whack. And then on top of that, it got completely, like, thwarted by Watson. So
yeah, but she's just, you know what it is that she's now kind of taken over where Mr. Astor is. This is the final battle. This she is at the forefront of society in a way, and they're sharing it. So it's kind of like a cold war between the two of them. They're like frenemies. Like, you know what I mean? Like, this is what it comes down to. Like, it's like, yeah, this battle for the operas feels like she's kind of like left that scrappiness to now she's like shaping the rooms that people want to be in. And this Duke is another piece in that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so I don't know, man. I kind of, speaking of the Duke, I'm seeing what Bertha's game is here. Unlike the last dinner, where she changed the place setting so she could sit next to the Duke. Now she is sitting next to the Duke, but she's made sure strategically that her daughter is sitting on the opposite side. And she is very much so, even in her conversation with Ward McAllister, like, well, let Gladys have that conversation and entertain him. And to what Ward McAllister says, well, let's hope that the Duke finds her as entertaining. And so it's very clear that there is a strategy here about Gladys and the Duke.
Okay. I feel inclined. There's been a lot of talk on the internet about this, like a lot. Mm-hmm. people are feeling a couple of things. A lot of fans have done their Googling and they know that the Russells are loosely based on the Vanderbilts. Mm-hmm. And Consuelo Vanderbilt married the Duke of Marlborough. Mm-hmm. He's a very well-known, well-respected lady of the late 19th century in England.
And that Duke was also, like related to Winston Churchill. Kind of wild. I just always find that fascinating.
The Duke of Marlborough is a Churchill. Yep. The Duke seems like a good guy for the most part. I don't have any beef with him. I think we should give him I don't think we should be prejudiced against him. I think this could be a really good match for Gladys. It would give her the kind of freedom that she's been craving in terms of she would be on another continent and able to, she'd be a duchess. She would be the head of a massive household, a leader of whatever area, of the Buckingham area. I actually have no idea where this dukedom is located, but whatever lands they have, she would be the lady of those lands. She would be almost like a mini queen, right? I think this could be potentially good for Gladys. That said, Gladys could not care less about this dude. She seems completely uninterested. What I want to see is this just going to cause friction between the Russells? Because as we said before, that phrase uttered in the first episode where he said that he would back Gladys when she's ready to marry for love, we knew that was going to become a thing. I think that's still going to become a thing. Or are they going to actually show us, like, is the Duke going to actually try to court Gladys? That would be a different scenario. This could potentially be a love match. We'll see.
It could definitely go that way. It could go like where she's uninterested and then he does try to court and then it switches. But, I think George is kind of trying to suss that out now because George has not seen, he's side-eyeing this whole situation. He's seeing everything. And then, your girl, why is she always in the mix, dropping little, like, observing things and then dropping little drama to create a little shakeup? Why is Aurora Fade in Mr. Russell's ear? Like, well, it seems like your daughter and your wife have fully occupied the Duke. I'm like, yo, Aurora, why are you pouring salt in the wound? Don't you see this man looking at everything side-eyed? I swear, yo, Aurora Fade is the worst. He's looking at it like, yo, what's going on? Like, what is this about? Because he even mentions, I'm sure that she has, a plan, right? And knows what she's doing. And Aurora Fane's like, yeah, you can be certain of that. Mm-hmm. And so I think, like, he's trying to suss out, okay, where is she going with this? But he's got bigger fish to fry in Pittsburgh. So I don't think he's like, and nothing's been made clear. So he's kind of moving on. But there is... the reason why this has been so big on the internet is because of the loose base. How much are they going to go with the Vanderbilt story where there was, an unhappy marriage that later led to divorce in the Vanderbilt's case, where you see the Russells are pretty happily married and there is no real strife to that level yet, but they've introduced the possibility of strife and them fighting in this season, which didn't exist in season one.
Yeah, totally. These two don't see eye to eye on everything, even though they love each other. And I don't know. I have to say that, like, I can't tell what Bertha's trying to do here. Is she... I guess what I want to see is, will Bertha want her daughter to be happy in the end, or will she just use Gladys as a pawn? I think the jury is out on that. Like, putting Gladys in front of a titled man that could improve her status and give her something that is, like, beyond Bertha's wildest dreams is actually her being a good mom. Like, that's what she's supposed to do, is put her in front of these men and try to get them interested and her interested in them. I guess I'm just wondering, like, where is this going? So I guess we'll see, right?
I mean, and to that end, that's where Mr. Russell may have walked himself. In modern day, we would think, oh, that's good parenting, right? But what he did. But in that time, he what like the way that he's like going after like everything in the business world and with his railroads and all things that he's doing, that's the same level of attention to detail that Bertha's putting into who the kids marry, what the standing they have in society, how their household is set up and run. And so for him to like already have a secret pact with Gladys to be like, yo, I'll stand up against your mom if she says you have to marry somebody you don't want to, it's kind of like her going to one of his business partners and being like, yo, if he makes the wrong deal, I'll back your hand. Like, it's not really what he should have done. He should have been more even and then had that conversation privately with Bertha.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's going to come up and he's already written a check that he might not be able to cash without blowing up his whole family.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you know, earlier in this episode, Bertha did say to Larry that all she wants is her children's happiness. So yeah. We can't, if we're going to hold on to what George said when he was talking to Gladys in episode one, we have to acknowledge that Bertha also, and I believed her when she said that to Larry, agreed, wants her children to be happy. I guess it comes down to what will make Gladys happy.
I do. I agree. I agree with that. And I also think, you know, the little known thing about that whole situation with the Vanderbilts is that it might or might not be basing the whole, it's inspired by, it's not definitely the Vanderbilt story, is that, you know, she did marry the Duke, and yeah, they eventually didn't work out the way they went to, but she went into it kind of, it sounded like she went into it as, she gave it a good go, and the best go she could. And so it could be that, you know, she relents to her mom's will without, you know, it fully being in her heart to do so, and then later realize that she's made a mistake. Could go that route too. You know what I mean? Like, so you never know how this is going to go. I just also think that Mrs. Russell, I mean, listen, I went back after our previous episode because we were talking about it, and because I couldn't remember. And I in season one, they talk about her family being potato farmers. And she's come a long way from a family of potato farmers, and she's probably going to try to figure out any way she can to make those final steps into, you know, so let's talk about what we Googled. So a couple of things, but the one we want to start off with is about Emily Warren Roebling and the Brooklyn Bridge. Okay. So she was born in Cold Springs, New York in 1843. Emily was the daughter of a civil engineer, and she developed an early interest in engineering and architecture. Emily married Washington Augustus Roebling, the chief engineer of the Brooklyn Bridge project, in 1865. Washington Roebling had taken over the project from his father, John A. Roebling, who died as a result of an accident during the bridge's early stages. Unfortunately, Washington Roebling himself later became incapacitated due to decompression sickness, commonly known as the bends, which he contracted while working on the watertight structures used in the bridge's construction. In the face of her husband's illness, Emily Roebling stepped in to assist the bridge's construction. Despite having no formal engineering training, she became deeply involved in the project. Emily took on the responsibilities of liaising with engineers, politicians, and workers, as well as managing day-to-day operations. She studied engineering and bridge construction principles extensively to effectively communicate with the project's engineers and workers also. The bridge opened to the public on May 24, 1883, and it was a significant engineering achievement of its time. Emily's role in the project earned her recognition and praise, but she often faced criticism and skepticism due to societal attitudes towards women in engineering during that era. After the completion of the Brooklyn Bridge, Emily remained active in various civic and social causes. She later moved to Trenton, New Jersey, where she lived until her death on February 28,
1903. I have two notes about this. One is a nitpick. The Brooklyn Bridge opened on May 24th, 1883. This season started on Easter. Let's do some quick math in there. We're talking about a matter of maybe 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And the bridge is still not open as of this episode, which means that Ada and Mr. Forte met courted and got married in a six weeks period. I don't buy that. It doesn't feel right. And in addition to that, just like the whole storyline of Mr. and Mrs. Blaine, of Larry and Mrs. Blaine, like all of it just feels really rushed for it to only be 6 weeks. So I'm assuming that in this universe, the Brooklyn Bridge is going to open sometime in the fall. It just seems way too fast for this, where we are, for to be.
Life comes at you fast when you're living in high society. You know what I mean? Like, I don't
not
know.
Not that fast. Listen, I don't know.
Oh, man, that's
great. It feels way, way, way too fast. And then the other thing, too, is I think I saw this noted on Reddit that the Newport season has begun on the show. Mm-hmm. That would have started around May and June.
Yeah, that's fair.
So clearly they've played with the timeline a little. I think it's mostly okay, but it I'm bugged a little bit by it. Like, I'm not gonna lie.
Listen,
those of you who listen to the pod know I can be a little bit, you know, a little bit stuck in these little details, but
at least they didn't get across the whole entire continent for a sword fight in the 11th hour within less than an episode. That is a deep cut for all the Witcher listeners. Oh my gosh. Anyway.
That was bizarre. This is less bizarre because there's obviously they're playing with history a lot here. A little frustrating. But that said, back to Emily Roebling. This is, as we said earlier, this is just like one of the coolest things that they've featured this season. Mm-hmm. One thing I really have to say about this show that I love is that they're not just focusing on like the industrial titans of the time who were mostly men, but also on the women who were trailblazing at the time. Clara Barton was in last season. We got Jane Addams being talked about in this season. Now we have Emily Roebling. Like, this is really cool. That on top of the fact that they're featuring prominent Black thinkers, journalists, educators at the time, that's also really cool. So props to the writing team for including this, because I just thought it was really, really neat. So we also wanted to talk about and put more context into what was happening in the South during this period. A lot of people think that Reconstruction is still happening in the 1880s. The Reconstruction was like the kind of post-Civil War time period where there was some real reconciliation happening in the South, but also they were basically just rebuilding and considering like rebuilding what the Southern society would look like in the post-war era. This is not Reconstruction. So in 1883, Reconstruction had ended about 4 years before. And so the Southern states formally ended the Reconstruction era in 1877, actually more than 4 years, when federal troops withdrew. And this marked a real turning point in the commitment to safeguarding the civil rights of Black Americans. So at this point, we enter the Jim Crow era, where segregation was enforced, often violently. There were the curtailing of freedoms by Black citizens in basically every sphere of life. People often use, like, you know, not being able to use the same water fountain or going to different schools. It touched every point of life, like even just walking down the street, having to step off the sidewalk if white people were walking in the other direction. In the agrarian South, the shackles of slavery may have been removed, but a new system emerged, which was sharecropping. Black Americans were trapped in this cycle of debt where they had to work the land in exchange for a share of the crops. Not every landlord was fair, though. So sometimes you would have a situation where the price of exchange would go up and up and up, and they would get a smaller and smaller share. Meanwhile, the Southern economy grappled with the aftermath of the war, attempting to transition from a slave-dependent system where everything was free, basically, like mm-hmm. you paid for the food and board, but you didn't have to pay any wages, to a free market labor-based system. As this federal oversight diminished, the southern states started erecting all kinds of legal barriers to voting, instituting poll taxes and literacy tests. In the 1880s, they also implemented the Jim Crow laws, as I mentioned, which forced racial segregation in all public facilities and in some private ones. And these laws basically were established and to maintain white supremacy, severely limiting the opportunities and the rights of Black Americans. Additionally, violence, as we saw in this episode, was routinely used as a tool of oppression. Lynch mobs, often composed by white men mostly, but white women also sometimes participated, would illegally seize and execute individuals, and they would face zero consequences for this. And it was used as a mean for racial terror. Like, the whole point was so that you would make sure that Black people were always too afraid to stand up, to fight back, to advance in any way. And they were used to intimidate and control, like economically and socially, Black Americans. So I just wanted to put that into larger context, because I think we kind of just got dropped in the South in these couple of episodes. We had that great discussion last episode between Mr. Washington and Mr. Fortune, but we are now seeing like what Mr. Washington and his wife, Mrs. Washington, were describing, which is just the pure terror that Black people live under, even when they're just going about their basic lives, like just eating in a restaurant.
100%. 100%. I'm glad we talked about that. Because like I said, I agree with everything we said earlier, that, you know, it's good that they addressed what was happening in the South. I hope that we spend more time there, or based on the repercussions from what happened. Maybe have some new information that's presented, but I'm glad that you read that and Googled that, so we can have some more context of the time period, what was happening in these specific years of 1883.
So. Yeah, I think I also had the idea that Reconstruction went on and through the 1880s, but mm-hmm. it was really only a little more than a decade of the Reconstruction era. And there's a lot to, sometimes I'm really shocked at like how much progress was made in a very short amount of time. You saw Black people being elected to office in Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. Former enslaved people were taking political office, and then there was a backlash to that, as there always is in American politics. Like, there's mm-hmm. always a backlash to any progress. So I thought it was just important to set the stage, like the Reconstruction era is over, the feds are no longer overseeing the progress, and as soon as they withdrew, this campaign of terror just like completely took over.
Whew. Man, there is so much that we're unpacking in these episodes, and we're glad that you're here hanging out with us. This is a really, really, really fun and informative show to cover. So glad you're here with us. If you want to engage in further conversation, hit us up at any of our socials, KinFolklorePod on Instagram and on Twitter. And you can reach out at kinfolklore@gmail.com. And we will see you next week.
Bye, everyone.